Welcome back. Over the last four lectures, I've talked about the rise of states in different parts of Africa. I've tried to, on the one hand, emphasize the diversity in cultural forms that we see associated with the state in these different parts of the continent. And I would note, as I do that, that we could have looked at a variety of other areas in Africa as well. So we see in the inland Niger Delta in Mali, on the Ethiopian plateau, to the south of Lake Chad, and on the Zimbabwe plateau, a whole variety of different pathways towards social hierarchy, political centralization, the rise of states and civilizations. But there are also some common elements that we can detect in these different cases as well. These include evidence for the intensification of agricultural systems, whether these involve African rice, sorghum and millet, teff on the Ethiopian plateau, or cattle. We can see the development of increasing elite control over particular kinds of wealth, gold, slaves, exotic goods. One thing I noted was that this requires a change in the way that wealth is perceived in many cases. These are less democratic forms of wealth than perhaps earlier ones, like cattle. They're easier to control. They're easier to monopolize. And what's that monopoly happening for? In many cases, another common factor, the expansion of networks of trade and exchange, both regionally and at longer distances, in many cases continental and intercontinental distances. These different factors are ones that we have, of course, seen repeatedly in other areas of the old world as well, because we've now looked at a whole variety of different civilizations in different parts of the old world, and now it's time to move. We're going to cross the Atlantic, or, depending on your orientation, cross the Pacific, I suppose, and begin to look to examine the rise of civilizations in the New World, in the Americas, and particularly in Mesoamerica and in South America. In some ways, the themes of social hierarchy, of urbanism and state formation in these regions resemble those in the old world, the ones that we've already seen in the Near East, in the Nile Valley, in the Indus Valley, in the Eastern Mediterranean, in China, in different parts of Africa. A whole variety of different themes, different issues that we need to confront. We need to think about control of territory versus, in some cases, control of urban areas. We have to keep paying attention to these potential dynamics between territorial states on the one hand and city states on the other, at the same time realizing that this may in some cases be an oversimplification and that a binary understanding of how states formed in ancient times may be too simplistic. We have to continue to look at the important role of agricultural intensification, exchange systems, and ideology and ritual practice in the origins of states. We have to pay continuing attention to what I might call the challenge of the chiefdom. More broadly, the understanding of transitional political forms between non-state and state. What comes before a state as states are forming? And is it useful to designate these intermediate forms through the single term chiefdom? We need to think more specifically of the challenges of understanding the roles of elites during these periods when states were coming into being. Elites that are almost by definition at the time that states are coming into being precarious, not widely accepted, not universally accepted. The divine right of kings takes some time to develop. What mechanisms do elites use to attain and consolidate rule over other groups? And particularly, how do certain members of the elite, certain groups within this larger population of the wealthy and the powerful, how do they manage to distinguish themselves from other elites in order, in many cases, to become rulers, kings, pharaohs, Wang? It's often been noted by archaeologists that this latter may in fact be as significant a question, as great a challenge, how rulers distinguish themselves from other members of the elite, as the question of how elites originally distinguish themselves from common people. So these are a set of concerns that are applicable across the whole world. They're going to be just as significant in Mesoamerica and South America as they were in different parts of the old world that we've looked at. In other ways, however, states seem to develop in slightly different trajectories and at somewhat different rates in the New World. And it's interesting to think about the environmental or perhaps other factors that might be involved in such differences. One of the major things we might look at is the ways in which agriculture and sedentary life, permanent settlement, developed in the New World. I've already spoken about the central importance of different agricultural systems as the basic mechanisms through which state-level societies and wider civilizations support themselves. These are often critically dependent upon the particular characteristics of a fairly small number of plants. And so the processes toward domestication, the kinds of environments that these plants require, are going to have ramifications through all of our understanding of state formation and the origins of civilizations, as they will in all other kinds of cultural factors, not merely in state-level societies. So domesticated plants were in use in the Americas at just about the same time as they were in the Old World, in the Near East, in the Levant, the area around the Eastern Mediterranean. That is about 10,000 years ago. But their context and usage in the New World was quite different in really remarkable ways. Archaeologists working in the Old World, and I include myself here, certainly, give primacy to cereal cultivation, to cereal domestication, as the real push toward agricultural systems. When we look at the origins of agriculture in the Near East, what do we look at? Wheat, barley. Other domesticated plants are certainly definitely allocated a secondary role. To some degree, they're archaeological afterthoughts for us. After wheat, barley, rice, sorghum, and other cereals, depending on the area. These are what we're looking out for. These cereal crops are what we're really looking out for first. We're so used to this. We're so used to this primacy of cereals in ancient agriculture that we're quite, in many ways, quite unconscious about it. We look for cereals, or perhaps in some cases, equivalent crops. I've mentioned, for example, yams in tropical Africa, potatoes in the Andes, manioc, bananas, depending on the area of the world. But these are all crops that, like the cereals, will take the same central role of supplying starch, supplying carbohydrate to the diets of farmers. We implicitly assume that since these are now the, quote, most important, unquote, crops in most of the farming systems that we know of today, they will equally be most important and thus developed and exploited and domesticated first in prehistoric societies as well. But that assumes that there's some inherent drive towards agriculture and permanent settlement, which we know isn't the case. People do not have to settle down. They do not have to become farmers. And in fact, there may be good reasons, convenience, efficiency, that they may want to remain hunters and gatherers. It's hard work farming. This has been established repeatedly ethnographically. This is hard work. It may not be that attractive unless populations are forced into it. So the issue is here, in the Americas then, in the New World, how did domestication take place? In the Americas, we have archaeological evidence that gourds were domesticated by between 10,000 and 8,000 BC. In fact, on genetic evidence, it seems possible that the earliest humans to reach the New World at some point before 12,000 BC carried domesticated gourds, calabashes with them, from Asia. The other domesticate that would have come along during the initial human settlement of the New World would have been dogs. These occupy, of course, very different positions within human societies than cattle, sheep, goats, pigs, and the other animal domesticates of the Old World, because they are not primarily food animals. These discoveries imply, of course, that gourds, this arguably appears to be the first domesticated plant in the New World, had actually been domesticated in the Old World at some date even before 12,000 BC. Such early domesticated gourds have not been found in the Old World, but as I've noted, archaeologists working in Asia or Africa or Europe have not really been looking for them at these early times. These very early domesticated gourds were almost certainly used as containers, not as food crops. And so it's very significant that the first known plant domesticate in the New World was not used for food. Such plants, utilized as containers, would be a valuable addition to a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. They'd make carriage, portability of items more straightforward. But they would not have contributed to a transformation in that lifestyle. Gourds would not turn foragers into farmers because they're not a food crop. That's a very, very significant difference between the Americas and the Old World. The great cereal crop of the New World is, of course, corn or maize, as it's usually known to Europeans. The domestication history of corn, let's move to food crops now. We'll leave gourds and their significance and we'll move to corn. The domestication history of corn is only now beginning to be understood. In part, because corn seems to have descended via a genetic transformation that may or may not be associated with its early use by humans from a wild grass called teosinte. This makes its ancestry much more difficult to study than is the case with, for example, the transition from wild to domesticated forms of wheat. Because with corn, there really is a transformation of the physical structure of the plant involved, especially with the appearance of real cobs on domesticated corn. With wheat, in the Old World, in the Near East, there's a transition from non-domesticated wheat to domesticated wheat that is a transition in the morphology, but not a transformation in the plant, so that we can recognize in the archaeological record when we have wild wheat and when we have domesticated wheat. But in the New World, in Mesoamerica, the physical transformation between teosinte and corn is more profound. This may also help to explain why the domestication of corn happens later than that of many equivalent old world domesticates, as I'll get to in a moment. Because as a genetic mutation, a genetic transformation in Teosinte, that domestication event may not have been under or not fully under human control. Teosinte, this ancestral plant, this ancestral grass, is now found in scattered stands in southern Mexico and Nicaragua. But its prehistoric distribution is not well understood. We have indirect evidence for corn cultivation in two different areas of the New World. Corn pollen has been found at sites along the coast of the Gulf of Mexico in Mexico, and particularly at the San Andres site. And this corn pollen is dated to about 5,000 BC, and it's likely that this comes from an early form of domesticated corn. Interestingly, a single grain of manioc or cassava pollen was found on the same site and dated to about 4,600 BC. Archaeologists do not place great weight on the appearance of one pollen grain because these can potentially move up or down in a soil column. But that occurrence is still important. Manioc would become an extremely sophisticated domesticate, especially for communities occupying tropical forest environments where corn does not often grow well. The remains of starch granules from corn have also been found in cooking pots from coastal Ecuador in South America, dating to about 4150 BC. Archaeologists found what were probably the remains of domesticated peppers in the same area and period. The earliest archaeological examples of domesticated corn, where we actually have the corn itself and not pollen or starch granules, the earliest archaeological examples of domesticated corn come from a cave, from Gila Nikitz Cave in Oaxaca State in southern Mexico, where tiny cobs had been dated to about 3450 BC. At Tehuacan, in neighboring Puebla State, similarly small cobs of corn are dated to about 2700 BC. Now think about those dates for a moment. We're now speaking of the 4th or 3rd millennia BC. At this point in the old world, wheat has been domesticated for many millennia. The same is true for rice. We have agricultural systems of great antiquity that have developed in the old world. The sophistication of farming systems in the Near East, in East Asia, in the Indus Valley, and in other areas at this point, already allows the development of sedentary communities, large populations, and is in some areas developing towards urban centers. But this is the time in Mesoamerica and in South America where we see the very first evidence of corn. More than that, in both of these cases, these Mexican cases, in Oaxaca and in Puebla, at Gila Nikitz and Tehuacan, the very small size of these earliest cobs of corn would severely limit their agricultural productivity, at least compared to more modern forms of corn. They're tiny, tiny cobs of corn. And of course, since they are so tiny, the yield on these strains of corn would have been significantly lower than it would be in later times. Full-scale corn agriculture appeared in these regions only in the 3rd millennium BC, with quite slow population growth thereafter. Probably, as I said, because these initial forms of corn would not have had high yields. Perhaps for this reason, the raising of corn and other domesticates seems to have been initially integrated, again, into a relatively mobile foraging lifestyle. So this is sort of a transitional economy between hunting and gathering on the one hand and farming on the other. And one could see how that would work. If the yield of the cereal is not such that it allows you to settle down, it may be much better to retain, to stay with hunting and gathering, foraging lifestyle that moves around and only depend on corn occasionally, or perhaps just at certain points during the year. Perhaps there are certain times when the community comes together for a few months, and that's long enough to plant a little corn and harvest it, and then you go back to the mobile lifestyle you knew before that. At the same time, we should remember that there are animal domesticates as well. But in comparison with the old world, there have been very few large animals domesticated in the new world. None larger than dogs in Mesoamerica. And only llamas and alpacas related to camels in South America. This simply seems to have been because there were not other domesticatable species available, as was the case in the old world. There's no ancient wild cattle, no ancestors of sheep and goat and pig and horse available to these New World populations. This as well has distinct economic and cultural consequences. Protein from domesticated stock would have been much rarer in the Americas. There are actually forms of dogs bred for their meat in Mesoamerica, which is a fairly desperate strategy if you're looking for protein, because carnivores are not particularly efficient at producing meat. In South America, guinea pigs as a protein source. Turkeys in Mesoamerica, certainly, but no equivalent of cattle or pigs or sheep or goat. In addition, the use of riding and traction animals for plowing, for example, and there's practice with economic implications, or pulling wagons. These uses of animals were more or less unknown. In South America, llamas and alpacas were used occasionally, particularly llamas for carrying goods, almost as donkeys would be, but that was the extent of it. A fully sedentary lifestyle in Mesoamerica, with permanent settlements, may have had to await two sets of innovations. First, the breeding of more productive forms of corn with larger cobs, and those begin to appear in the archaeological record only after 2000 BC. Again, late. And also the widespread adoption of domesticated beans and squash, particularly the former, because beans provide an excellent dietary complement to corn, especially in circumstances where, as I noted, domesticated animal protein is always going to be in short supply compared to the old world. Thus, communities that seem to be more or less sedentary appear relatively late in the Mesoamerican archaeological record. By the late 3rd millennium BC in Mexico, Guatemala, and Belize. This slightly predates our first evidence for these more productive forms of corn, but not by very much. And it may well simply be that we simply haven't found these more productive forms of corn on these particular sites yet. These initial permanent communities are small farming settlements. They occupy both tropical lowlands and highland environments with perhaps 200 to 300 people per settlement at a maximum. We know that these farming communities were trading extensively with one another. Again, drawing much of particularly lowland Mesoamerica into networks of economic and social interaction. This process would intensify in later periods and would very quickly begin to bring in highland Mesoamerica, and particularly the Valley of Mexico, the area around what's now Mexico City. This area would be drawn into these exchange systems as well. In some parts of this region, as at San Jose Mogote in Oaxaca at 1600 BC, ritual structures probably men's houses, where in particular high-status men could meet, were being built in these farming villages. Such structures and the activities that took place within them would provide an ideological basis for communal action in later periods. Through most of the second millennium BC, through this initial period of development of farming systems, of the expansion of permanent settlements through different parts of Mesoamerica, in the lowlands and in the highlands, there's little evidence for status differences in these Mesoamerican communities. However, that would change by the end of the second millennium BC. Thus again, at San Jose Mogote, significant changes would occur after about 1300 BC, so a few hundred years later. After this period, after about 1300 BC, an elite group is increasingly easy to distinguish in this community. Members of this elite group were living in larger and more complex structures than were their neighbors. They were being buried with elaborate grave goods, often involving materials like jade, rare, valuable, probably unavailable to the population as a whole. And jade remains a material with great cultural and ideological significance through the rest of Mesoamerican prehistory. These populations in Oaxaca begin to practice a ritual skull deformation that will continue to be a mark of nobility in later times. And one thing I want to note is this is a system in which during infancy, children of this elite would have their heads bound tightly to boards to provide infant skulls are relatively malleable, relatively plastic, so to speak, and would provide a sort of an elongated shape to the skull. And this was associated with noble birth. And, you know, I want to note how efficient a system this is. It marks a person as a member of the elite for life. It doesn't matter what clothes you're wearing, what goods you have with you. It's the shape of your skull. Alternatively, there's no way that you can bluff your way into the elite if your head isn't the right shape. It's a very efficient system. These people begin to replace the earlier men's houses found on sites like San Jose Mogote with temples built on pyramidal platforms. Similar processes seem to have been going on 350 kilometers, about 220 miles to the northwest at Tlapacoya, Tlatilco, and related villages in the Valley of Mexico, in the area, as I said, where we now find Mexico City, from about 1400 BC onward. Most of what we know about the archaeology of these communities comes from grave sites. And these have revealed the same kind of high-status graves with valuable and exotic objects and evidence of cranial deformation as found at San Jose Mogote. In these and other areas, archaeologists sometimes also see evidence of contact with contemporary Olmec communities developing along the Gulf of Mexico in what's now Mexico's Veracruz state. Researchers have debated the nature of Olmec influence on neighboring societies in Mesoamerica for the last 60 years at least. And we're going to examine the development and characteristics of Olmec society and the vexed question of its relations with contemporary societies in my next lecture. Thank you.